You are live with the App Show. Mike Agarbo here with Gray Williams today. Our show is all about the world of apps and mobile technology. You can hear us across the Chorus Radio Network and, of course, listen to our podcast of this program as well at your favorite podcasting app or site. We have a great program. We will be talking a lot about AI this week. One of the stories is about OpenAI. They're the folks behind ChatGPT. It's one of the more popular AI tools out there that allows you to, within seconds, literally write entire essays, letters, business plans, social media plans as well, even code websites. Amazing tool. But to be amazing, it has to get that information from somewhere. So there's a lot of people sparking up now saying, hey, that thing has ingested information about my book or my writing without my permission. Sarah Silverman, you know, the comedian, she's suing. But there's also now a class action lawsuit against OpenAI. And we'll be talking with Carmi Levy, who will be coming in to give us an understanding of what that all means. We were worried about the robots and AI taking over. It's the lawyers that are going to save us, Gray.
God bless.
God bless. And we're going to do a deep dive into the actors' strike. The actors have gone on strike down in the U.S. The studios want access to the actors' images and likeness so that they can use them for AI purposes, being able to regenerate them for other shows and movies. Well, the actors' union, as you can imagine, not happy about that. They want control of their actors' likeness. So we'll get an understanding of what that all means and where we think it might go as well. And a fun little segment. I'm going to call it the top 10 unhappy apps. There's a lot of apps that make us happy, Gray, that we use every day. But one website came up. They did a poll of the top 10 apps that make their users unhappy. So it's kind of a fun thing to go through. And, you know, you should tune in for that because maybe the apps you're using are on that list and you can kind of identify with it. Let's talk about some of the news out there in the app and mobile world. I don't know if you saw this. Again, this is kind of in the AI vein. Google, they are obviously trying to step up their artificial intelligence side. They've got something called Bard, which they're trying to compete against ChatGPT. They've had a few kind of challenges along the way there, a couple, screw-ups, in some of the demos, but still a very powerful tool. The underlying technology of that, of the language model from Google on their Bard, is called Palm 2. And so they've got a variant of it called Med Palm 2. And apparently, Gray, this is interesting, the Mayo Clinic Research Hospital, among others, is actually testing this now as a doctor or a medical chatbot where you can talk to it to get medical information.
This is way better than WebMD. I'm so excited for this.
I know. Hypochondriacs of the world rejoice, right?
Yeah, but it's going to feel so much warmer, so much more interactive. And every time that I learn that it's probably lupus, it'll be there to comfort me. I like this.
Yeah, I know a lot of people are listening to this. I'm not going to talk to a doctor chatbot. You know, that's stupid. Like, I want a human diagnosing me. But, you know, their mission here is not to replace doctors. They're basically saying that this would be a potential tool for locations, countries, regions where medical professionals, as you can imagine, might not be available. maybe Canada, right? Can't seem to get a family doctor. but it's interesting, right? You know, they're testing it out. They're saying it's not 100% accurate, and I can see that, right? Because it's still kind of in its infancy. What they are saying is that it has a really good comprehension of the data coming in and understanding of that. But I could see this being a useful tool, though, Gray, like in conjunction with a human doctor, right? Because you want that human connection, first of all, and, you know, their experiences. But, you know, if they had access to a medical chatbot that, you know, basically had, you know, the world's medical information and all the diagnoses around the world in this one place. Wouldn't that be valuable?
Absolutely. You know, it's funny, for the smaller things that I've gone to my family doctor for, because I do have a family doctor, you know, usually I sit down, I describe the problem, she leans over, looks at a reference book or types it into a website, goes, yeah, I think that's what that is. We could save her so much more time. She could focus on things that actually need her attention. And my silly little issues could be dealt with the chatbot. That is triage in the best way. I like this.
But would you feel comfortable with that? Like if you knew your doctor?
Yeah.
Okay, so you feel comfortable with the doctor using it. What about using it yourself? What if it's just that,
honestly,
that was your doctor?
Yeah. You know, so here's the thing. It's all about triage, right? If I'm able to feed what... So I do this already with Teladoc, an online doctor service, where there's an app. And I sit there and I've waited like 2-3 hours to get a real doctor sometimes. And if they could just have this chatbot listen to my concern and go, yeah, that's nothing. Or, you know, we're going to prescribe this. Or we're going to get you to see a specialist.
Yeah,
you're saving the doctor time. You're saving me time.
Yeah, I don't know. I still take comfort in knowing that, you know, there's a human. Do you know what I mean? I wonder about the liability as well in the future. Like if you're just having people interact with medical chatbots and they give bad information, you know, obviously, you know, there would be all sorts of warnings around it. But, you know, what is the liability of a medical chatbot, you know, basically saying you have cancer or you don't have cancer? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I think that, again, when it gets to that level, it's going to kick it up to a real human, but maybe not. Maybe we've got House MD. That's the chatbot. Bard's going to be very, very bold about the fact that it's definitely not Lipus.
Yeah, anyway, so again, we're talking about Google, their MedPalm 2. This is a variant of some of their AI technology. They're testing it with hospitals like the Mayo Clinic Research Center just to see how well it works in, I guess, that setting. Another interesting story here, the Associated Press and OpenAI are entering into a 2-year partnership to help train algorithmic models. Isn't that interesting? I mean, that it's a big issue right now. There's class action suits happening against OpenAI because they're saying that OpenAI is ingesting all, you know, this copyrighted and trademarked information. But now the Associated Press, which is, you know, a big news organization, is looking to work with them.
It's can't beat them, join them.
Yeah. So it doesn't involve, you know, the AI chatbots, you know, really churning out content, but for in a way for OpenAI to train its algorithmic models, which is interesting. So the 2-year deal gives OpenAI access to selected news content and tech from the AP archives dating back all the way to 1985. So they're saying that this will help improve the efficacy of ChatGPT and its tools going forward.
Nice.
But I just, again, the only reason that these AI tools like ChatGPT are so powerful is because of all the information they're ingesting. Like, can you imagine how many deals they would have to make with all the content providers? Like, it would be insane.
I imagine they probably got an AI working on the number of deals. At least I hope they do.
The scope is too large for me to comprehend, but obviously something that the lawyers are going to have to deal with. And it's part of our upcoming segment as well, talking about some of the class action lawsuits against OpenAI. You are tuned in to The App Show. We have a lot of great content coming up, including the actor strike and how AI is playing a big role in that. And we will also be talking about the top 10 unhappy apps. So these are apps that users say make them unhappy. And it's interesting. It's a mixture of games, social media sites, dating apps, as you can probably imagine. So stay tuned and see if an app that makes you unhappy is in that list. Anyway, it's just a fun list that we wanted to share with the listeners. You are listening to The App Show with Mike and Gray. We'll be back shortly after this. You are back with the program. Mike Agarbo here in studio. Want to talk about AI some more. Obviously, that's a hot topic in the news this past year. One of the big tools is from a company called OpenAI. It's ChatGPT. I think 20% of Canadians are now using it in some form, whether for work or personal use. It's an amazing tool. It can just kind of punch out blogs, social media posts, essays, pretty much anything you can imagine within seconds with great accuracy. But where are they getting all the information from? This is a interesting developing story. We've got Carmi Levy with us. Thanks for joining us, Carmi.
Great to be here, Mike. Thanks for having me.
So to get this smart, tools like ChatGPT have to ingest incredible amounts of information to basically train them. But now OpenAI is being sued for copyright infringements from, a lot of people, you know, especially authors of books that say that their books are being ingested into this this tool without their permission.
Yeah, I mean, if we look at AI, I mean, you touched on it in the intro, right? It's they are trained using massive amounts of data just out there on the internet, on the open internet. It's almost like a Hoover. You target the vacuum on websites, social media streams, online communities and forums, whatever it can find, pull that data in and then unleash the AI tools on it to draw connections and sort of create that what looks like intelligence, and then subsequently build new content. That's why they call it generative AI. Build new content based on all that old stuff that it vacuumed up. The problem here is that it comes from, some of that data is your data. It's my data. It's our listeners' data. It's just been out there for years. I've been writing a blog for going on 20 years, and I'm reasonably certain that my blog has been scraped multiple times by AI training bots that are looking for data. I never consented to that. When I first started posting all this stuff online, I didn't agree to it. There was a terms of use statement that, of course, I read. Most people don't, but I read it, and it didn't say anything about AI, and it really didn't predict this future this future technology. And so there is a lawsuit in California, a class action suit that's just been filed that says that OpenAI, which is the company behind ChatGPT, that they didn't follow proper procurement guidelines. They didn't seek the consent of all of those folks, including all of us, who produced that content in the first place. And they're calling it data theft, which is a pretty serious allegation, basically saying you stole our data and now you're using it to create all sorts of new content and products and things that you're then going to make profit off of, and you're not going to give any of that to us. And so it's a really important turning point in the history of AI, because the very architecture of AI is based on this mass data training, and now we're seeing the legal challenge to that. Which I think is a reasonable thing to do. I think as society, we need to understand the moral, ethical, and legal implications of this, wholesale data scooping, which you and I never agreed to all those years back. And unfortunately, now we find ourselves on the wrong side of that curve.
Isn't it ironic? I think of that movie, The Terminator, and, the robot from the future, and nothing could stop it. But clearly, lawyers could.
Yeah. Well, didn't Al Capone get taken down for tax evasion, right? It's always the little bit of legalese that will sort of take down the most powerful adversaries. And I think it's fair for us to look at AI through that lens, right? We've been talking about ethics and morals and all that. And really, I think the answer to ensuring that AI does not harm society more than it benefits it over the next few years is that we need to have the right kind of legal framework in place, because you can talk morals and ethics till you're blue in the face. We know full well that it's the law that has the final say. And so, we are seeing signs of legal activity here, opportunistic lawyers who are getting in on it early, as they should, and asking questions about, if we don't have a legal framework for AI because all this technology is so new, should we in fact start building one? And lawsuits like this establish the precedents that lead to the creation of better legislation. And even though this is happening in California, which is a very progressive state when it comes to tech-forward legislation, it is a common law state, right? The entire U.S. is common law, which, of course, most of Canada outside of Quebec follows. So whatever precedent is set in this particular case will send seismic rumblings through the entire legal community. It will cross the border, and ultimately it will apply here in Canada as well. So it's certainly something that I'm going to be watching, because, you know, up until now, we've been watching AI race ahead with no legal protections whatsoever. And cases like this are really critical in getting that ball rolling so we can close that map.
I'm still laughing, like, governments can't stop the advancement of AI. You know what I mean? Like, they're trying to legislate to slow down whatever that means. And it's the lawyers. It's the lawyers that are gonna take
always
it down.
Always the lawyers, isn't it?
Oh my God! But Carmi, I don't even know how you would figure that all out. Like, I can't even fathom the intense amount of books and articles that, you know, these large language models are ingesting. You know, obviously to train themselves. I can see there's an argument if you've put something on the internet. Maybe it is public domain, but some of the stuff, like, you know, actual novels and textbooks and things like that, like, those are copyrighted. Those are protected.
Sure. They're protected legally, but, you know, because of the way the technology works and because of the fact that it's very opaque, there's nothing transparent about the way all of this data is collected. OpenAI hasn't told us with any clarity precisely how it trained its large language models or what happens to all that data once it gets ingested. And so somewhere between where it gets ingested from my website and my social media feeds to where it gets spit back out when someone gives it a query, I don't know what happens. It's a giant black box. And I'm kind of hoping that at some point we establish a legislative framework that forces companies like OpenAI to be more transparent about what's happening inside that black box, right? We deserve to know, because if we're going to protect ourselves against the worst potential for abuse within an AI-powered world, we're going to have to know a little bit more about how that technology works. And we kind of missed that opportunity with search when Google first became a thing, when all the other search engines were being introduced in the mid to late 90s before Google came along. We didn't really talk about the legalities of that because we know that search engines are indexing and spidering and pulling in information as well, but that never became a legal thing. But compared to search, AI is on a whole other scale, a whole much larger scale, and I think the impact is much more significant now. So we're getting a second chance to figure it out, and I'm really hoping we take the lawyers up on that opportunity, because if we don't, then essentially the internet becomes a free-for-all where anyone can do anything and nothing is protected. And I don't think any of us want part of that dystopian future.
Been talking with Carmi Levy about AI technology and specifically class action lawsuit against OpenAI for, I guess, their scraping of the internet and all the content that goes into training their ChatGPT large language model. Okay, we're going to have to take a break. When we come back, more tech to talk. Back after this. You are back with The App Show. Mike Agarbo here in studio. I've got my good friend Carmi Levy with me. He's out of Toronto and really up on the whole AI, I guess, topic and issues around that. We're going to talk now about the actors strike happening down in the U.S. And one of the big sticking points between the movie studios and the actors would be AI and the studios being able to use the images of actors whenever they want. Carmi, this is an issue now. But first of all, I just have to bring up one thing. I didn't know Fran Drescher was the president of the Actors Union, the nanny, essentially. I think that was the biggest surprise to me out of that story.
Well, yeah, Fran Drescher now, I mean, Melissa Gilbert in an earlier age, you never quite know where your favorite child actors, you know, or childhood actors from a bygone era are going to end up. But I think it reinforces that, you know, the Screen Actors Guild kind of has to have someone who, you know, A, speaks passionately about their craft, comes from their craft, in other words, has lived the reality, and certainly Fran Drescher has as, you know, a woman in 80s and 90s Hollywood fighting her way to the top. Who better to be that sort of voice of an entire industry than someone who learned the hard way and survived and thrived? So I didn't know either, and I started seeing her as part of the coverage of the actor strike, and I thought, cool, I will never look at her exclusively through a the nanny lens again.
So there was a couple sticking points in the negotiation. Streaming, which was no surprise to me. You know, obviously the actors want to be able to be compensated for their work on all the streaming platforms properly. But the AI proposal, from what I understand, if I just kind of simplify it, they're proposing that background performers should be able to be scanned, get paid for just the one day's pay, and then the company, the studios, would be able to scan their image, their likeness, and be able to use it for the rest of eternity in any project.
Yeah, so, you know, work once, get paid some, you know, piddling amounts, and then basically you've signed away any rights to the studios for perpetuity, and you're never going to get any work from them again. What a great deal for the studios. I mean, as soon as I saw that particular clause, I was mortified. I say this, I'm not an actor, but I'm a content producer. And in my world, you know, the things that I produce, the value of what I produce, that's how I keep the lights on. That's how I make my living. And so essentially what the studios were saying was, we're just not going to have to pay you overtime, and we're going to use AI to completely replace you, which is beyond unacceptable, beyond immoral. And even though we don't have AI-specific laws in place yet, there's nothing stopping the Screen Actors Guild from drawing a line in the sand and saying, no, that needs to stop. And I think they are kind of the canary in the coal mine for AI, that industries are going to try to use it as a way of obsoleting entire classes of workers. And I think we've seen technology disrupt entire industries before, but this willing use of the technology to very blatantly tell actors that their contributions are not valued is unacceptable. And you don't have to be an actor to recognize that. I think anybody in a content-heavy industry recognizes that if this is allowed to happen in the acting space, it'll be allowed to happen in any other space, because it'll set a very dangerous precedent. So, you know, within that context, I think the actors are kind of fighting for the rest of us.
So the Alliance of Motion Picture and Television Producers, AMPTP, great name. they basically issued a statement countering what the Actors Union is saying. They're basically saying the claim made by SAG, which is the Actors Union, that the digital replicas of background actors may be used in perpetuity with no consent or compensation is false. In fact, the current proposal only permits a company to use the digital replica of a background actor in the motion picture for which the background actor is employed. Any other use requires the background actor's consent and bargaining for the use, subject to a minimum payment. So, you know, obviously there's a lot of details going on here, but I think, you know, the Actors Union definitely, they're really trying to shine a lens on the challenge that AI does, you know, cause.
I think because of the power of AI to replicate content rather faithfully in any number of contexts going forward, you know, we need to be careful of how it can be abused, and how even a small concession up front can become a very big consequence over time. And so even though the producers are essentially saying, no, it all, we're digital replicas only apply to the existing movie, so any other work will have to arrange something else. The problem here is it's a slippery slope. And by allowing digital replicas to be used in an existing work, you're opening the door for the next step. And it's like death by a thousand cuts. You're allowing the industry to say, hey, we allowed you, you said yes for this film. Let's push it a little bit further next time. Now let's negotiate the envelope getting a little bit broader. Maybe for another film, maybe for other works within a series, or maybe for other works done by a particular producer. So, you know, either you draw a line now and you stop that Pandora's box from being opened up, or you run the risk of the industry, now that they've got their foot in the door, they're going to try to kick it wide open with the next round of negotiations. And so, again, I understand the PR mavens who are kind of weighing in and splitting hairs and looking at particular particular definitions of legal clauses in contracts. But the reality is, if we allow the small concession now, it becomes a very large concession later on. And that's dangerous, not just to actors, but to all of us.
I guess for the more well-known actors, they have a little more control, I guess, of their likenesses. You know, they've got better lawyers when they're putting their contracts together. But, you know, already there are actors out there basically saying they are not going to give permission for their likeness mm-hmm. to be used in any, you know, films or TV programs. I think Keanu Reeves is one of them.
Yeah, and I think that makes it makes sense. It's interesting because James Earl Jones got a lot of attention a few months ago when he said he was going to sign away the rights to his voice, so that, you know, after he passes away, the baselines of his voice can be used to create new content based on his intellectual property. But thing is, James Earl Jones is a huge star, and he's over 90 years old, and he's, you know, at some point he's approaching the end of his career. He can afford to do that. But if you're and Keanu Reeves, good on him, recognizes that he's still fairly mid-career, and that he still has earning potential ahead of him, and he has the clout to say, I'm not going to allow that to happen. And I think most actors are kind of see that, is that if you still have earning potential and a number of years in the business ahead of you, why would you sign those rights away, right? Why would you give producers the power to use AI to essentially reduce your potential to do work going forward? AI should enhance the work. It should not replace the people who create the value in that work. And so I think we are going to see more content producers, more actors, more talent get on that bandwagon and recognize that you know, having even a small allowance for AI to replace part of your work opens the door to you basically having no career in a few years. And it's one thing if you're a major talent, a major actor with a brand that everybody recognizes. But the thing is, the vast majority of those actors out there, we've never heard of them, right? Most actors are struggling to keep the lights on and make ends meet. The George Clooney's and the Keanu Reeves of the world are the tiny minority of the entire actors union. And so really what we're doing is we're fighting for the small guy who goes to Hollywood with a dream, for them to have an ability to find work in future. And if we allow unchecked AI to basically rifle its way through the industry, we prevent that in much the same way that, you know, the incentive for teenage kids to become rock stars and practice in their garage, not quite the same now than it was even a few years ago because of this unchecked advances in technology. We kind of missed the boat with music. We probably shouldn't miss the boat with acting.
It's going to be interesting. This could be a potential gold rush for certain actors. I'm looking at the music industry, for example, like Bob Dylan and Bruce Springsteen, basically selling, you know, the rights to their entire music catalog, you know what I mean, for hundreds of millions of dollars. I could see a point where an actor, let's use Kevin Costner, for example, basically write a deal that would give away the rights to his likeness, you know, for AI created content, you know, when he dies or sooner, if he's open to that, for millions of dollars.
Oh, sure. And I think if you have spent an entire career building your brand, and you've reached a point of success where people know you, you're a huge star, and you want to cash in on it, then good on you. The fear here is that as, you know, Bruce Springsteen and Bob Dylan and others cash in on that, and kind of hand over the rights to whoever buys them to, you know, use what they've already created, or also use AI to extend that envelope somewhat, is that you're closing the door on all the unknowns who want to be the next Bruce Springsteen, or be the next Keanu Reeves, or be the next James Earl Jones, because they won't even have the opportunity to get there. They'll be, because of AI, they will never be allowed to create the kind of brand that made today's big stars possible. We have to ask ourselves a question, you know, what kind of industry do we want? Why do we follow a particular star? Because they're a person we're interested in. Would I be as interested in AI-generated content based on someone I know? Probably not. in much the same way that I probably wouldn't want to watch a TV show that was written by AI and acted by AI actors. It just doesn't have the same appeal to me. And I think
not yet.
Not yet. We will get there though. Yeah. But you know, and that's kind of what scares me about what's coming, is that folks are just going to use the technology for the sake of it, but forgetting why we're interested in things like television shows, movies, and music in the first place.
Talking with Carmi Levy all about AI and the sticking point that it is in the current actors' strike. So we'll be following up to see how that all plays out. Carmi, thanks for joining us.
So great being here, Mike. Thank you.
When we come back from the break, more tech to talk. Back after this. You are back with the program. Mike Agarbo here with Gray Williams. Apps are a major part of our life. They do everything from online banking to gaming to social media. There's a lot of apps that make us happy. Wanted to talk about some of the apps that make us most unhappy. And this is a list from moment.io. But before we get into this this list of unhappy apps, Gray, are there any that come to mind for you?
Oh, the weather app makes me unhappy.
Is that the app's fault, or is just you just don't like the weather?
You know, I'm gonna say it's 50-50. I just don't like the weather.
Okay.
It's always too hot, it's always too cold, it's always too raining. I should stay inside.
Okay, so you're gonna blame the app for that?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, who else?
Okay, so I'm gonna go through a list of the top 10 most unhappy apps. And so this was, I guess, an informal poll that Moment.io and HumanTech.com did. Number 10, I haven't heard of this one, Subway Surf. Is one that people don't like. Number 9, this was interesting, Tinder. This made 56% of users unhappy. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah. And their husbands and wives also happy.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, when you look at some of these lists of unhappy users, many of them typically are dating apps or social media apps, which is kind of interesting. Weibo is up there. So that's more of a Chinese social media app.
It's sort of like a pervasive app.
Yeah.
Is it not? Like it's shopping and search and all that sort of stuff. Yeah. So imagine if it touches more parts of your life, you're going to be less happy.
So apparently 57% of the users there are unhappy. But what's interesting is how much daily usage people spend on these different apps. So with Weibo, again, kind of a social shopping app, you know, more on the Asian side, 73 minutes a day. Isn't that crazy? Okay. Next, Tweetbot.
That is.
Tweetbot, that's number 7 in the unhappy app list. Obviously, you know, an app that integrates with your Twitter. I don't think a lot of people are happy using Twitter right now.
I wonder if there's a Threadbot coming.
Probably. Next one at number 6 of unhappy apps, Reddit. So Reddit is a very popular kind of almost like a message board for the internet. They call it the... Isn't it the message or the front page of the internet? They call themselves that. You know, daily usage from users, about 56 minutes. That's, I mean, almost an hour. That's a lot. But apparently 58% of users are unhappy. I guess it gets pretty heated on there sometimes.
It does. And
yeah.
I mean, for a lot of users, the main Reddit app is not that great. With the API thing that's just gone down, where they were charging developers way too much to make apps that work with Reddit, the official app is the only thing left. So it's a case of it's the only thing and it's terrible.
Number 5, we're talking about the most unhappy apps. 59% of users using this app, and they're averaging about 47 minutes a day on it, Candy Crush. I didn't see that coming.
Really?
Candy Crush, it's a very popular game. Been around for a number of years now. You see it in movies and TV shows, you know, people playing Candy Crush, but I don't know why people are unhappy.
Yeah, I think it's the fact that it's almost like a bit of a slot machine. You just have to keep putting money in to get your energy back to play at a consistent rate. Just get Apple Arcade, people.
Get Apple Arcade. We're talking about the top 10 list of unhappy apps. And this is a, you know, an informal poll done by the folks over at Momento.io. Just kind of checking in on people, letting them know what their unhappy apps are. Number four is WeChat. Very popular Chinese messaging app. Again, ties in with a whole bunch of different things, but amazing how much people use it. It's 97 minutes of daily use. Isn't that crazy?
Yeah.
That's like over an hour and a half.
Being interconnected with all those services, it makes a lot of sense. And again, if you're not happy with one part of it, you're probably not happy with all of it.
Okay, number three, not a big surprise to me. What do you think it is? It's a social app.
Facebook?
Yes.
Yeah.
well, you know what? Facebook, they have a lot of usage. You know, I mean, how much? They're close to 3 billion active users a month. On average, these users that, you know, went into this informal poll say they use it about almost an hour a day. 64% of them were unhappy using it.
Yep.
It's kind of sad, isn't it?
Yeah.
I don't know. Like,
yeah. I just use Facebook to complain about Facebook.
Yeah, you use Facebook. Do you like it? Are you unhappy? Yeah.
I wouldn't say I'm happy. I'm saying, like, it's sort of a, there were moments of joy at the beginning of Facebook.
Yeah.
And then that joy was stolen away. Although I will say, when it comes down to Twitter versus Threads, Mark Zuckerberg has done the impossible and made me like him again.
Really? So,
I don't know what to do.
Oh, don't worry. He'll do something to make you not like him again. And so, okay, number two on the most unhappy apps. And this is just an informal poll that a website did. Candy Crush comes up again. Candy Crush Saga. God, oh, okay. They just can't catch a break. 71% of the people polled in this poll were unhappy using it. Spending about 46 minutes on average a day.
That's and that 47th minute, usually yelling, this is bull crap, and throwing their phone across the room.
Yeah. I guess it's, you know, they're tired of crushing candy, so to speak. okay, so coming up on number one, this is another dating app. Guesses? We already covered Tinder. Tinder was number nine on the unhappy scale.
Lava Life? I don't know.
Grindr,
really?
Yeah.
Oh.
77% of the users polled in this survey are unhappy using it. And they use it on average.
Are they unhappy with the app, or are they unhappy with the experience?
Saying the app. Or using it. So, you know, on average, they're using it for like an hour. Tinder, which we talked about, which was at number nine of the unhappiness in the app here, top 10, only 22 minutes. It's a big...
Yeah, that scans.
It's a big discrepancy.
Yeah.
Okay, well, next week, we'll talk about some of the happier apps. But I just thought it was interesting that someone made a list of unhappy apps. Don't forget to listen to our sister show. It's called Get Connected. We're on every Saturday across the Chorus Radio Network. You can also check out the podcast from your favorite podcast app. We're going to be talking about the FTC cracking down on fake reviews. Also, an interactive rower, kind of like a Peloton for rowing. And the FBI is warning U.S. citizens of sextortion scams that are increasing using deep fakes. So fake pictures of people and videos that look real. They've got your head on them. I want to thank all the folks that helped out in the show today. Gray Williams and Carmi Levy for coming on. We'll see you again next time.
Canada may be known for its landscapes and friendly people, but beneath the surface lies a darker side of crime, history, and the paranormal. Since 2017, the award-winning Dark Poutine podcast has explored the shadowy corners of the Great White North and beyond, delivering chilling tales from a uniquely Canadian perspective. Hosted by Mike Brown and Matthew Stockton, with over 300 episodes and fresh releases every Monday, Dark Poutine is your weekly ticket to the creepier side of Canada. Listen to Dark Poutine on Apple, Spotify, Amazon Music, or wherever you get your podcasts.